a system fusion, a gateway, and there's Brandmeister, which operates mostly DMR, but it also cross-connects to fusion and D-Star reflectors. So little by little, people are building these little tunnels connecting one digital technology network to a completely different digital technology network, because primarily it's just a matter of internet protocol packets. So it's good programming on his part, but it's not magic. And so you can use, in the old days you needed to have at least a radio to supply the voice encoding decoding, because the Raspberry Pis didn't include that, and so you needed that little extra speed bump. So you had to have either a D-Star radio or a DMR radio or a Fusion radio. With BlueDV, if you can get it to work, you don't need any of that. You just plug a microphone into your computer, and away you go.
Yeah, I remember the old time, there was a, 32 bits microcontroller, 17 centimeters transceiver, that was 422, 450, that was modulator, demodulator, GMSK, and 4FSK modes. What else was that? Yeah, there was a software, DCS, XRF. I'm trying to recall it, but question, how is D-Star now?
Say again, Wesley, I didn't quite catch that question.
The D-Star network, there was ESO, I believe. How is D-Star right now?
D-Star is alive and well. There is a local repeater, NC2EC, that's D-Star based. It has access, it's linked to one of the reflectors, reflector 20 alpha. There aren't as many as there used to be. When I first got into this hobby about 9 years ago, it was a different thing entirely. That was before Fusion was even being promoted or sold. So you had a smattering of DMR. You had a significant number of D-Star at that time. As time has moved on, there have been more and more used Motorola repeaters sold to amateur radio operators, and locally the landscape has shifted to mostly DMR repeaters. There is a few Fusion. There's only a few digital D-Star. The overwhelming majority, at least locally, and it changes, you go from region to region, and you find these interesting preferences. But in the metropolitan area, especially on UHF, it lights up. There's at least six different DMR stations. Often they're linked to the same public network, and so I can see all of them rising and dropping at the same time on my fan adapter.
Thank you very much for this information.
You're welcome, Wesley. So once again, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. My name is Roy, Romeo Oscar Yankee, and this is the Limark Technical Mess. So we have a few more minutes. If you have any other questions of either a technical nature, or you want to discuss some aspect of the COVID-19 that you heard about, feel free at this time. I'm listening.
On a chat room, somebody put the link to the small spectrum analyzer. I'm trying to get to it. The TNSA, something like that. Yeah. Anybody had something to do with it?
You're alluding to the fact that in the chat room, KD2TNS put up a link to the tiny spectrum analyzer. And I'll put it up on my link page. What the heck? If anyone's interested, it's kind of a spectrum analyzer take on probably the nano DNA, a probably an inexpensive Chinese manufacturer. I'm not really familiar with it, so I can't tell you if it's great or terrible. But every new toy, especially if it's inexpensive. You know, we're talking about that vector network analyzers. When they were first invented as a concept, those things were incredibly pricey. None of us would buy a brand new shiny first line VNA unless we wanted to sell our house to pay the bill.
Yeah, some information. A teeny spectral analyzer, TNSA. 0.1 megahertz, 100 kilohertz to 250 megahertz. 250 megahertz is not enough for 2450, so this would be not covered. MF, HF, VH, okay. It's nothing. Resolution bandpass filters from 2.6 to 640 kilohertz. Color display. Full frequency range. Input step attenuator. 0 to 31 dB, not bad for such a toy. It looks nice. I mean, it looks nice when I look at the pictures. It has high and low. Two ports. Built-in calibration, so you don't have to hustle with it. But usually most of the guys never calibrate spectrum analyzer. They are quickly trying to just look at the curve. Rechargeable battery, 2 hours only. So you got to be quick on the roof, on the mast. And nothing more of the technical description, I see it. Hold on. Bandpass filter. Practically everything what I said. Internal structure, the frequencies, tracking generator. No kidding. Okay. N2XJ and Dr. Roy.
Okay, like I said, I'm not going to guarantee or warranty it, but it sounds like a fascinating little toy, and it might be practical and it might be improved. A gentleman emailed me about how best to use a nano VNA to check out a ballon that he came across, and I was looking up the subject, and although it's very simple to detect the impedance transformations of a ballon with a VNA, it's not a trivial thing to figure out its common mode rejection ratio. But you can do it a little bit easier with a spectrum analyzer and a tracking generator. So that might be a less expensive, less mathematically intensive way of checking out an unknown ballon, because sometimes ballons are very good as far as impedance transformation, but they are terrible as far as common mode blocking. And I've linked to a YouTube where a gentleman actually shows different ballons that have good, bad, and indifferent characteristics in different ways.
KC2FYJ comment.
Yes, Harry.
Hi. I just thought you might be interested to know that Neil Goldstein had done a presentation at a LIMARC meeting at the very beginning of this year, January or February, on the VNA top hat for the Raspberry Pi, and I believe his presentation is available on his website, although I can't tell you what the URL is offhand.
Okay, very good. I think I heard about it when it was scheduled and planned. As I said, the nano VNAs have people have been chattering about it on the technical net for a couple years now. At first it was more of just a kind of a rumor. We sort of know that it It existed, and there were forums about it, but you never know anyone personally who had kind of had much experience. But, yeah, I could understand that Neil loves these kind of gadgets as well as us, and so he would be on the bleeding edge there.
As a matter of fact, he demoed it at Ham Radio 2020, January, and I believe he did it in the February Limark meeting, if I remember correctly.
Okay, very good. And what's particularly good is he made a copy of the presentation, and hopefully it's available. Someone wrote, Ken, WB2KWC, thank you very much, that Neil's site is called fofio.com, which is an interesting choice for a domain, fofio.com.
And one more thing?
Yeah, one more thing, Wes.
I do thank you, Andy, for excellent explanation of impedance matching, but I gave the question, what is the difference between impedance matching and resonance? And then he said one has nothing to do with the other. Job? Think about that. You have a transmitter that must match 250 ohm of the coax. The coax must match of the 50 ohm of an antenna. An antenna must be in resonance. If those things don't happen, you're not going to have a power. Oh, actually, there was maximum power discussed. Let me drop. Maximum power is transferred from source to the load when load resistance equals the source resistance and the load resistance equals the negative of the source reactance. The negative is capacitive reactance. Another way of saying it is that the load impedance must equal the complex conjugate of the source impedance. If this condition is met, the two parts of the circuits are said to be impedance matched. So in other words, antenna must be in resonance. And in resonance, capacitive and inductive reactances cancel each other. And we are left only with pure resistance, if there is any. Or usually there is any, but could be omittable. So first you must match impedance, and then you must resonate. And then when you resonate, you can get your power out at a maximum power transferred. Dr. Roy.
Well, I agree with you. The power theory is that the maximum power transfer in an impedance circuit is to have the load, the complex conjugate of the source, and that will transfer half of the power, giving you the highest power output, but not necessarily the highest efficiency. So the problem, though, is not all resonances are 50 ohms. In fact, a lot of resonances are not 50 ohms. An actual dipole in free space has a resonant impedance of approximately 73 ohms, not 50. So there are usually impedance-matching circuits at the feed point of antennas. So that is a little added complication on this whole thing.
And another thing is I'm not going to take a piece of pie from Andy's lecture, because he is a great guy, undeniably great guy, and I love his lectures. He mentioned about the phase role in the circuit, and talking about the transformers, he was probably having in mind the power transfer, and not always there is a transformer that has a permalloy metal in the core, most likely you're going to have in higher frequencies just air core. So there would be two or more coils in a filter. Antonio.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to the next parts of Andy's presentation. You know, there is actually one transformer out there that is both a primary and a secondary in the same wire, an auto transformer. So transformers also, I mean, a lot of these things are very basic, very fundamental, but they lend themselves to an infinite number of branch points where you can discuss all kinds of interesting things about electronics in general and radio theory in particular.
Yeah, then here we go back to Vector Network Analyzer. That's why he said I'm wondering what Andy is going to say about a phase role in this area. The Vector Network Analyzer over the wide band gives you the complex filter-like structures with many components. And if you have a resonant circuit and you're trying to find out the impedance match, you're actually dealing with impedance match if the frequency is changed at new frequencies. So impedance matching over the wide band will generally require complex filter-like structures with many components, except in the trivial case of constant source and load the resistances when the transformer can be used. Usually transformers are used in the kilohertz range frequencies, so most of the ham radio operators, unless those operators are dealing with 157, boy, I forgot. What is the low frequency band? Ham radio frequency band 157 or 37. Actually, there are two bands, but I have never been there. Intuition.
Yeah, I think the lowest of the low experimental bands is 37 kilocycles.
Yeah, but there is another one, 100 something. That's low frequency in kilohertz. The ham radio band, and there is a number of hams that are experimenting on it. They are allowed to be there, and there is a certain power level for it to be used, but it's absolutely exciting. In our hobby, the most what is disappointing is a boredom, because at a certain point you know something. And there is nothing new that is coming out. So for those who wants to play with those bands, there is plenty of activity there.
Well, I agree with you, Wesley. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this tonight. I think the subject is full of interesting nooks and crannies. I feel sorry for guys who find all of this boring. You know, there are, you know, different strokes for different folks, as the old saying goes. But it's a fascinating subject to me and to you. And if you don't like this aspect, there are 3,000 other aspects to the hobby. You know, just as much as I feel sorry for guys who are bored, I feel sorry for guys who get into this hobby, buy a Baofeng, and that's as far as they take the hobby. It seems that I don't think they really gave the hobby a chance. But, you know, there's a lot of people with Baofeng at the bottom and the back of their drawers in their desks from the time that they were a ham that 5 minutes. But, you know, the best we can do is spread the good word.
Comment?
Yes, comment away.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, the 2200 meter band, that's at 137 kilohertz. 137 kilohertz is the low frequency amateur band. It's 2200 meters. Also, I think there is one at 496 kilohertz, but don't quote me on that. But the lowest one is 137 kilohertz, 2200 meters.
Okay, thanks, John. I for some odd reason I can't keep it in my head. I always kind of say to myself that theoretically I really should be interested more in this because the nickname that these guys give themselves because they're low frequency enthusiasts is loafers, and my last name is Laufer, so I just thought it was cute. But since my backyard is about 20 feet by 25 feet, there's not much you can really do with that type of backyard as far as picking up these very low frequency signals.
Well, I have a problem with that. If you recall Dick Ward, it doesn't matter how small is the antenna as long as it resonates. And there are a number of techniques for you to make an antenna that will electrically look long, but it will be absolutely short physically for the transmitter that is connected to it. And that's by Dr. Corum, James Corum, and Trishian.
Well, I agree with you in principle. You could make a physically shortened antenna, and everyone who had an AM radio is well aware of a coiled wire ferrite bar antenna. It worked very well. Its efficiency was not very good, but your local AM broadcaster was throwing lots and lots of watts into the air to make up for it. We could discuss this for a day and a half, if not more. I don't want to take any more time away from Paul. So, Wesley, I appreciate your participation. I think it's time to roll this up for tonight and move on to the space report.
Absolutely agree, and we have exciting news for today. And to you, and thank you very much.
Yes, indeed. I just want to remind people, if you have any mailbag questions, the address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Links to different places, I'll put up a link to Neil's blog that I think has his presentation on the nano-VNA and the page to look at the little spectrum analyzer, and you can find that on roy.ac2gs.com. And as always, MikeKC2NJI has his archive site. His website is amateurradio.tv. And he has archives of the Technical Net going back to September of 2006. So without any further ado, let me pass the baton to Paul, WS2N, with a space report with some exciting news today.
AC2GS, WS2N. Very good, Roy, and good net so far, that's for sure. And exciting news. Well, the whole week had exciting news for the space industry. In particular, Thursday was the launch of the Perseverance Mars rover, which launched on time. And I thought, you know, well, that's pretty much the main news for the week. And then, sure enough, they had the landing of the first crew back on the Dragon crew vehicle. They call it Demo 2. And that was today. I thought it might be delayed. You know, they had a hurricane coming toward Florida. And they were thinking about possibly delaying it to some degree. But they had multiple landing zones. Six or seven landing zones that they could go to. So that's what happened. They were planning on landing in the Atlantic Ocean. Let me drop it. Near Florida. But because that hurricane is... They actually, at one point, they didn't know where the hurricane was going to go, if it was going to go into the Gulf or not. but that's going up the eastern seaboard. So the second choice was in the Gulf of Mexico near Pensacola, Florida. So that was the plan, and everything went exactly to the exact time for what they had planned. The rocket launched originally on May 30th, so they were up there for a little over two months. And when I say they, it was Doug Curley was the commander, and Bob Benkin. Bob Benkin was a ham radio operator, so Doug didn't have his license. But the two of them went up there, and they spent a couple of months working with the crew that was up there. There were three other people, two Russians, and Chris Cassidy, another ham. So they teamed up and helped out in a couple of EVAs to go out and fix up the International Space Station with batteries. They finished up the battery project, which has been going on for almost 3 years now. And that's changing out all the big main batteries that operate the space station. You have solar cells that charge them, and then they discharge it when Earth goes there. When the space station gets behind the Earth, so that happens 15 times a day, charge, discharge, and after almost two decades, these things will wore out. Well, they helped with the EVAs on that, but now it was time to come home. They had a bit of a ceremony leaving. Doug Hurley gets to bring the flag, the American flag, back. He's got that with him in the crew compartment. And that American flag, the idea of that was the last crew vehicle that went up to the space station from the United States was Atlantis back in 2011. And they had brought a flag up, and they put it on a wall on the space station. And the idea was whatever crew comes up next, whatever it might be, whatever company, it might be Starliner from Boeing. In this case, it was Dragon from SpaceX. They would bring the flag back. So that was accomplished. Yesterday, roughly 24 hours before the landing, they separate from the International Space Station with a couple of burns. They have actually three different burns to slowly remove themselves away from the space station. And it happens all autonomously. The crew could break in and take over if they wanted to, but Dragon is set up to launch from Launch Complex 39A, which it did, all the way to the space station. It stayed there for 2 months. They went in and out of it and made sure everything was operating correctly during those couple of months. But then the computers also bring it all the way down. Also, Mission Control could intervene, and they could take over as well. So after the three burns, they got a good distance away from the space station. And then they eventually went to sleep. The next morning, they wake up, which is this point, and they initiate. The idea was to initiate a final burn, but to get to that point, they have to get rid of what's called the trunk. Now, you can see the spacecraft. It looks like a big capsule. Behind it, equal size. That's what we call the service module. They call it the trunk. So the service module had to be separated first. The idea is it comes through the atmosphere. So they have this floor, they call it the floor, and it's just this one big main connection between the service module or the trunk and the crew compartment, the Dragon itself. And through that they have connections. They have fluid connections. They have power connections. That's where all the solar panels are located on the, they're on the trunk. They also have data connections. So that all has to be seven. The floor gets released, and then the trunk eventually separates a minute or so later. and that truck eventually burns up in the atmosphere. And the crew then faces the front of the spacecraft in the forward direction. And they have these four Draco engines that they... Draco engines all over the crew vehicle. But these four are the main ones to deorbit. And, if you look at it, it's right in the front of it, they have this nose cone that's opened up. The nose cone is opened up, not 90 degrees, but even more, around 110 degrees. So it's opened up very wide, and that opens up for a number of reasons. One, that's where you get the access to the dock. When they dock to the International Space Station, there's an international docking dock that they dock to. That cone is open, so that they're able to have this, a little over a meter wide space where they can, open it up and eventually climb into a pressure mating adapter one, which leads into the International Space Station. So that's one reason that nose cone has to be open. The other one is, if you look at it, there's four ports facing in that direction. And that's what they use to deorbit. So with that door open, they fired those four Draco engines, and that slowed them down enough to actually come out of orbit. They do this over Australia, and by doing it there, halfway around the globe, they wind up back in Florida, in this case, Pensacola, Florida. And this is WS2N. The vehicle starts to slow down. Shield faces in the forward direction. They have little attitude Draco jets all over the vehicle. Like I said before, there's like 18 of them, and that keeps the attitude in the proper direction as they start to come through the atmosphere. Eventually, that heat shield starts picking up a lot of degrees, over 3,000 degrees in temperature. And that creates an ionization around it. And anytime a spacecraft comes through the atmosphere, there's always this ionization that's created, and you wind up with a 6-minute blackout. You can't communicate with the spacecraft. You can't send digital commands up to the space station. You can't get telemetry out of it, out of the spacecraft. None of that occurs. You're on a blackout. But the computer itself on board, like I said earlier on, is completely autonomous. So it knows where it is in space. It knows where it's going. It knows where the second choice for landing is in Pensacola, Florida, or the Gulf of Mexico, actually, right off the coast of Pensacola. With that, the two drogue chutes, two small chutes come firing out of the spacecraft and start to slow it down. That happens around 18,000 feet, so roughly a little over 3 miles up. And then you start slowing down the heat shield gets you down to around 350 miles an hour from your original 17,000 miles an hour. So you're down to 350 miles an hour. The drogue chutes come out. They slow you down for a few more, for a couple more thousand feet, until you get to around 1 mile off the ground, around 6,000 feet up. Then these big four main parachutes come flying out of the vehicle, and they all open up. Look, the monitor was perfectly done, and that eventually slowed the craft down to, from 120 miles an hour to only 15 miles an hour when it hits the water. And you'll see the spacecraft coming down on an angle. It's conical shape, but the blunt end doesn't hit the water first. the way parachutes come out, they're coming out more or less on the side of the vehicle itself, so the vehicle's on a tilt. So you have the edge of the heat shield that hits the water first, cuts into the water, and it softens the blow. And the chairs, of course, are all inside are built to withstand this. They have shock absorber type of system in it. And that was pretty good. They landed, looked like a couple miles away from where they needed to be. They have two fast boats from SpaceX, which go out there immediately to see how the crew is doing. One vehicle's job is to get near the spacecraft and start sniffing around, make sure there's no fumes coming off of it from the rocket engines, not to make sure nothing's left, because the fuel that they use is carcinogenic. So you don't want to inhale that. And then the other fast boat goes over and starts picking up all the four parachutes. After the vehicle lands, it automatically severs the parachutes, and they're just floating in the water. The other boat picks up the parachutes, and they'll bring them back, examine them, make sure they withstood everything. And then what happens is there's another boat that comes that's on its way, and that's slower than the fast boat, but it goes around 25 miles an hour. And eventually that pulls up to the Dragon, and then that has this complex hook situation, which is able to grab it and pull it out of the sea. One instance they did have, because they were so close to land when they did this, there were some pleasure boats out there, and they're out there, float by, and I don't think NASA thought enough that these people would really be out there trying to come close to the vehicle. But it did send radio marine, they transmitted on the marine radios to make sure these people keep away. The ones that were nearby, get rid of them, and we don't want anybody else. But you could see them in the background, all lined up, watching what was going on. But because of those fumes that come off of there, I heard the NASA administrator during his conference, he said, basically this is not going to happen again. We can't have that. So they'll watch out for that next time they come down for a landing. You don't need personal boats coming near the spacecraft. So with that, they got it onto the boat, they call it Go Navigator was the name of the boat. There's another boat exactly like it in the Atlantic Ocean called Go Searcher, which would have done the same thing. That was the original choice for the landing, but they went to Plan B. The crane pulled up the crew, and they got it on deck, and then they noticed that there was some fumes. They have quality air detectors. Workers outside that they could detect more of these fumes. And one fume they were detecting was nitrogen type trioxide, which is an oxidizer. Usually when you mix it with the fuel, which is methylhydrazine, then you have hypergolic explosions, that's what drives these thrusters. But they noticed there was some. So that delayed looked like around a half hour. They wanted to get the door open, but they didn't want to bring Bob and Doug out into an atmosphere that was filled with carcinogenic fumes. So they waited for to purge it. I guess they had some fans or whatever it was. They waited until the numbers went down to zero, and eventually they got them out on stretches. After a couple of months in space, you just don't get out and start walking around. So they put them on a stretcher immediately, brought them into a medical facility on the boat. and checked out there, and eventually a helicopter lands on that same boat. A little helipad on a boat. The crew gets in, and they fly back to, well, in this case, to Pensacola, and then they have a NASA jet waiting for them to take them back to Houston. And that was the end of the flight of Demo. Interesting. I'm looking forward to the next one. Any questions or comments? This is WS2N for the Space Net Report for the TechNet.
AC2LR.
BK, AC2LR, go ahead.
When astronauts come in that fast, do they black out from the G-force, or are they feeling something different inside the capsule?
Doug Curley, who was an FCA, reported back he was up to 3.5 Gs when they were coming back, which is roughly the same as what they get going uphill, 3.5 Gs. So they can handle that. You can handle up to, I think, test pilots could do 11 Gs. The early Redstone rockets that Alan Shepard flew on and Gus Grissom, they got up to 9 Gs. So, they don't black out. In fact, Bridenstine, during the news conference, described it as, and Bridenstine is the NASA administrator, he described it as, a powerful roller coaster. Back to you, Kevin.
Thanks. Interesting report.
Stacey,
you want to say? I always try to remember to see them. That come back that have these chemicals on board. They are working on other fuels that are not carcinogenic, the so-called green fuels. They've tested some in space on unmanned craft so far, and they look promising. But these have been around for a long time. You could leave them in these tanks for hundreds of days, and you don't have a problem igniting them when you need them. The next crew that goes up is going to be staying for 6 months. So, you're going to need these chemicals to be able to withstand that. They have no problem doing that. The only problem is if you get a couple of whiffs of it, they tend to be carcinogenic. Shuttle missions that came back, another one, the X-37B, that's the unmanned one that goes up to space, spends years in orbit, comes back and lands on a runway, it looks like a small space shuttle, that's unmanned, but when they come back, you always see the hazmat guys out there with detectors and fans and blowers, to make sure that there's no residual fumes around before they start working on the vehicle. So that's the story on that. It was pretty good. Looking forward to the next one. And that would be, originally it was going to be, they were thinking about the end of August, but last I heard, we're looking at the end of September. So that will be another crew. You have three NASA people and one guy from actually two NASA people, a person and one guy from the European Space Agency and another guy from JAXA, the Japanese Space Agency. We have Hopkins. He's going to be the commander. Michael Hopkins. He's been up before. And then you have Victor Grover. He'll be a pilot. And you have another person that's been up there before, Shannon Walker. This is the flight you have three. You got three NASA people and just one guy from Japan. And the guy from Japan, Sachi Noguchi, he's been up there
on the space station for 6 months at a time as well, so he's been there before. It's the flight after that that they're going to have one guy from the European Space Agency. And they have those people fixed as well. And they'll go up, you know, roughly, they'll go up in September and probably come back, you know, in March, April or something, and then the other crew will go up. So I'll be sending up four at a time. This is two. This is really a test mission. And after this, you'll have four people at a time, which will really help out the space station. The space station generally has a crew of six. They've had that for quite a few years now. And there's a lot of time with, you know, spent with the science missions, but there's also a lot of maintenance of the space station itself. And they figured out they get around 35 hours of actual real science time by the astronauts. And the rest of the time is spent maintaining themselves in the space station. But by adding one more guy, by adding a crew of four, that will actually make it a crew of seven. To show you, the Russians always have a crew of three up there. You will be doubling the amount of time for science. And how is that done? Well, they do a total of 35 hours of science stuff, and the rest of it maintaining the space station with the whole crew of six. You bring one guy up there, I mean, he's going to be essentially, I mean, he'll be doing it, but essentially he won't be doing any work. They don't need his hours to fill in to do the work on the space station. His would be dedicated the whole 35 hours. So you'd be doubling science capabilities by the crew. I mean, there's a lot of science things that are going on that they don't even need a crew for. They have things that are working. Worked by Mission Control in Houston, and they operate things themselves. So there's about, you know, there's 400 science things going on at a time on the space station. But the ones that you need human care is roughly 35 hours, and by this new system, they'll double that. Any questions? WS2S.
KC1SAM. How you doing, Paul? Nice to hear you. I was watching some yesterday, and I watched it today. It looked like they went into the capsule yesterday to get prepared for the trip home. I got the impression they stayed in it, like, from yesterday to today. Is that correct? Which is kind of surprising. But is that really what went on, or did we didn't see them get out and go back in?
Yeah, yesterday afternoon they went inside and they closed the door behind them, you know, and then they do vacuum checks and everything and make sure everything's burned to get away from the station. You know, they move slowly away from it. And then, they're actually in a lower orbit. They actually are going in front of the space station as they go. But they're actually in a lower orbit by doing what they did with those three little burns. And then they're not deorbited yet. They're still, you know, the space station is 250 miles up. They're still, you know, 225 miles up. Let's go up that way. And they're still in orbit, and then they go to sleep. There's actually food on board. They have water on board. They could stay in orbit for 3 or 4 days with the Dragon spacecraft. And they had their sleep period. Woke up this morning, and then they got ready for this. Put their spacesuits on. They have big white spacesuits, and that's exactly what they did. So it was roughly 24 hours. If you start watching NASA when they started with, you know, getting into the spacecraft and everything yesterday, turned it on 3 o'clock in the morning. They were still on. They just ran the whole time. That was pretty good. And then, which is interesting, you know, you get people writing in questions, and they read the questions and you give the answers. Back to you, Sam.
Yeah, I watched some of it yesterday. I didn't watch it a lot, but I got that impression. Then I watched a lot of it today. I had it on. There was NASA on the computer. I don't know what's going on. I was doing some reading and some stuff. And the only thing, it was pretty good coverage. You know, a lot of cameras inside the that castle. Except when they started to do the forensic come down, they shut those cameras off. Well, they didn't show them anyway. I'm assuming that was on purpose. I thought that would have been interesting. But anyway, it was good. It was a very, very interesting, successful mission. But I didn't watch it until 3 in the morning. I bet you did. Anyway, I'll give it back to you. Casey, what I say. Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, you can hear the audio. They have that to keep the TV link on. With the thing moving around, they have to change different directions. The attitude, I think they might lose the link too many times. Try to keep the TV going. They have the screens in front of them. They have tablets. They're essentially reading the tablets on what step they're up to next, and then they can see the data of where they are and what they're doing on the screen. Like I said earlier, they have the capability to try to take it over. Going uphill when they flew up May 30th, a couple of months ago. Since it is a test mission, they did deactivate the autonomous system for a while and let Doug Hurley fly the thing, maneuvered in space. They wanted to know, SpaceX wanted to know if it was, similar to the, to what they, what's involved with simulators. Interesting thing that they said during a news conference is, this is the second flight. They had another Dragon go up. Two marches ago, and that was an unmanned flight, but it was just like this. I mean, it could have been manned. The idea was to test to see if this thing can go up autonomously, dock, come back, and they've actually gone through all of this without a crew. That
time,
what they did is they had microphones inside that original spacecraft, the demo spacecraft, and they did recording. And they did recordings of what it sounds like when these different engines are ignited, thrusters and the noises that they hear, and latches unlocking, when they unlock, you have like the nose cone when that comes in and latches in. It's got two sets of hooks, so it doesn't come back in and just slams. Lock it's motorized, and it comes back down, and then eventually it has some latches that slowly pull it tighter and tighter until it locks in 100%. All these things make noises, so they took those noises and the exact noises from the original demo spacecraft that went up without the crew and put it into the simulators. And when you're making a move or you thruster is firing, the guy in the simulator can hear these noises, and it duplicates what they're hearing, which is nice, because then, for like this mission, when Bob and Doug Hurley went up there, they were more or less used to the sounds that they're going to hear. I thought that was pretty good. Any questions? WS2M. Perseverance launch. That was the Mars 2020 launch. Before I run out of time here. That launched last week. It was July 30th, actually, the launch of that. So it just launched last week on Thursday. and successfully launched from Launch Complex 40 from Florida, and it launched on an Atlas V rocket with 4 solid boosters on it to help it get off the ground. I know I've been talking about the rover for it seems like years now, but Perseverance did make it off the ground, and now it's on the way to Mars. It had two little glitches on the way up. Communications with the deep space network, because it was so close to the Earth in the beginning, the transmitters overwhelmed the deep space network, so they were having trouble copying it. So what they did is they screwed the antennas off to one side to actually weaken the signal, to actually pick up the signals better from the spacecraft and that worked. And then they had another glitch with the cooling of the vehicle inside the cruise stage that takes it all the way to Mars. You have to get rid of the heat, so they have a freon loop that picks up that heat and it moves it to the exterior radiator to cool it off. So this telemetry on board, these things are autonomous. Point where practically you don't even need mission control. It detected that the discharge side where the heat was being discharged on the radiator was too cold. And what happened is they were behind the Earth, and the sun was they call it eclipsing the sun. And at that point, it got too cold. Originally, they thought it was going to be not as cold, so they have these different limits, highs and lows, and it went past that, and it put the whole space. And they figured out what it was. They could send commands up to the spacecraft. They sent commands to reset itself and add it back in business. It's happened before. In fact, it's happened to the rovers when they're on the planet itself. They run into difficulties. They'll have computers. They have two computers on Curiosity. And if one fails for any reason, the other one becomes a backup. But before that happens, it goes through safe mode, and then Mission Control at Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California would send up a signal to essentially reboot it or go over to computer B. Similar type of thing happened. It wasn't with the spacecraft. It wasn't the rover, but it was the cruise part of that vehicle that holds the rover. All the way to Mars, and eventually that will separate. That piece will eventually go into a heliocentric orbit, and the rover will eventually go through the atmosphere. They call it EDL, entry, descent, and landing. And so all is well with Perseverance. It's on its way, and I'm glad it is. That's the one with the helicopter on the bottom of it. The land is going to, after a couple of months, be on the ground. It's the loudest helicopter to fly. It's got the MOXIE on board. MOXIE is a test unit to take the atmosphere of Mars, take the carbon dioxide, convert that, change it to oxygen, and see if they could store like a liter of oxygen out of the Martian atmosphere. And they think it's going to work. They want to actually prove that it works on Mars. And then, of course, they'll send larger units up in the future. Because especially if you ever send people, you're going to need oxygen for either breathing or mixing with hydrogen to create water or for fuel. Any comments or questions about Perseverance, the 2020 rover, on the way to Mars? Okay. Well, nothing hard. But
KD2NVB.
You know, we follow all of these stories. There's another one. Not as dramatic, but Virgin Galactic is still at it. They're trying to get their spacecraft ready. That's one that goes suborbital when you go into space.